Hello, this is Russ Chianelli welcoming you to another Science Studio. Keith Pannell is on travel, so I'm here today by myself. And today we're going to talk about some interesting materials that are going to help us harvest light in a better way. And to help us here, we have Professor Xiaoqin Li, who we also call Elaine. She's from the physics department at the University of Texas at Austin. And welcome to Science Studio, Elaine.
Thank you.
We'd like to know how you got into physics. Tell us a little bit about your background.
So I grew up in China, Beijing, China. Physics has always been one of my favorite subjects in high school. So after high school, I kind of decided I want to become a high school teacher. So I went to Beijing Normal University. The system is built after the Soviet Union. So the idea is that most of the people graduate from that university would go on become high school teachers. But it is a comprehensive university. And there, my college professor encouraged me to come to U.S. for graduate education.
What year was that approximately? How long have you been in the U.S.?
I came here in 97. So it's been about 15 years. Time flies.
Yeah, I was in Beijing recently. Do you go back at all? It's changed quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. I go back quite often. You know, I normally go back once every year. I haven't traveled for 2 years because I had twins last year.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to talk a little bit about Beijing because when I was there about a year ago, they were building all these buildings that were unoccupied.
Well, that I don't know about, but every time, the last few times when I went back to visit my parents, they moved 3 to 4 times during the last few years, and every time I couldn't find my home. There's so many things are being built.
But let's go back. You said that in high school you latched on to physics.
Right.
Well, what about earlier? We've had some guests that say, well, you know, when I was 10, I looked at the stars or something like that. What got you interested in physics?
Well, I really can't remember something that far that really hooked me on for physics. But, you know, in general, I just like the logic. You know, I'm just enjoying the logical thinking. And the fact that the difference between physics and math is, of course, the physics, it deals with the real world, right? The math can be just self-consistent logical, if that's sufficient. But physics describe the real world. I like to tell my students, sometimes people think physics is just math. But
well, that's the barrier for a lot of them, is the math.
That's right. But, you know, math is really just a language for physics. The goal of physics and math are very different as two subdisciplines. Physics are trying to describe the real world. And then a lot of time you do need to use somewhat sophisticated math, like calculus, right? Calculus was invented to describe physics problems.
Well, I can't resist asking you this because we've had some very stellar physicists here on Science Studio. Mm-hmm. And it seems as if physics has a problem right now. We only understand about 17% of the matter.
Probably less than that. Like, we don't understand dark matter at all, right? Dark energy.
Yeah.
That's right.
So what do you think about that? I mean, that's something that keeps a lot of us awake at night because...
then we might be swallowed by these mysterious dark matter.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to worry about that. The fact is they're so hard to detect. You know, we don't have direct experimental evidence. But then when you account for how much mass should be there in the universe, clearly the observables are small fractions. You know, that doesn't really keep me awake at night. I'm not worried.
Well, this business that the universe is accelerating, for example, was a big surprise because when I was in school, it was very compact, collapse, explode. And now everything's in question.
Well, I think a good way to think about it, the more we know, it's like if we draw a circle that represents our known knowledge, well, as our knowledge expands, you start to draw a bigger circle. And that bigger circle, you can think about the contact area is contact and unknown. The bigger our knowledge, as we accumulate our knowledge, we actually are in contact with a broader unknown sets of problems. So that's kind of a natural in my mind.
If you go back 500 years and here was a guy, the Earth was the center of the universe, and all of a sudden this guy with a telescope says, no, we're not.
That's exactly right, right? As we build new tools, we can see further, and we realize there's so much more we don't know. So this is what's fascinating about science. It's never going to be, you're never going to reach the end. There's always and known to explore a higher goal to achieve.
So what you would say is some of those physicists that used to say, we understand everything, don't question us, are a little arrogant maybe?
Yeah, I would certainly say that.
So let's go back to, so then you came here, mm-hmm. you were influenced by somebody in China that said come to the U.S.
Right.
1997.
Correct.
And you came to the U.S. and you got your degree where?
University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Right.
Okay, so you went straight through for your PhD there, or how
That's
did
right.
that work?
That's right. So I was a little bit lost about what to study. You know, I didn't know whether I wanted to do theory or experiments. So it took me a little while to settle down in a particular field, I would say.
Okay, so this particular field that you settled down mm-hmm. in, let me ask you in your own words to mm-hmm. describe it. Mm-hmm.
So it really is about using laser to study nanomaterials.
Why don't you tell our audience what, in your definition, is a nanomaterial?
Okay, so that's a very good question. Nanomaterial just refers to things that has more dimensions, right? In really the advanced research, material research these days, almost everybody is dealing with nanomaterials. It's not just a matter of how big the length scale matters. It's when the phenomena that we call quantum phenomena come to play. Right? That's when there's a fundamental change in how material property depends on length scale. So that's what's exciting about it.
Because I've worked in the field of catalysts for, you know, 30 years, mm-hmm. it was kind of a fad. I said, the catalysts were always nanomaterials.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
But let me explain that a little bit, because I understand what you're saying. As you make the particle smaller, mm-hmm. all of a sudden what happens, you get to a region where the electrons are now more constrained, or the photons are more constrained.
Correct.
And what that does is change either the optical properties mm-hmm. or so on and so forth.
Correct.
So the process of studying these materials is to try to understand, as you make them smaller, mm-hmm. how the properties change.
Correct.
And is that useful in some way?
That's right. So absolutely, that's our belief. And that's why we study these nanomaterials. You know, for example, one of the things we study is called quantum dots. It just represents that you have one type of material surrounded by another type of materials. And like you said, what it does is that it really kind of squeezes the space that electron can occupy. And then that changes the kind of energy level electron can occupy. Right? One of the fundamental things about quantum mechanics is that there's only certain energy states that's allowed for atoms, for electrons in a piece of solid materials. For example, in the case of a quantum dot, imagine you have a basketball. Now you start shrinking it to a soccer ball, then to a baseball, right? And nothing fundamentally changes.
Into a golf ball, because we have like golfers out there.
Okay, here. So into a golf ball. Nothing has fundamentally changed about them. But for quantum dots, when you squeeze the size of a quantum dot from 5 nanometer to 4 nanometer to 2 nanometer, the color that emits changed really from, you know, say, yellow, green to yellow to red.
You know what's an interesting case about that? If you take a gold colloids, mm-hmm. They can be purple, green, different colors in solution.
That's right. That's right.
And that depends, the color depends upon the size.
That's right.
But here's the interesting thing. If you go back to about 600 AD mm-hmm. in Europe,
right.
What were the doctors doing then, or the alchemists? They were prescribing these, you know, you have something wrong here, take this red one.
Yeah.
And people were taking these colloids
yeah.
as medicines. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, today people are studying them for medicines again because they work.
Right. So I think we certainly have a different view about how they work now, right? And we're using them for a different purpose. And like you said, a lot of these materials are being used centuries ago. You know, you mentioned gold particles, and they are in the color glasses and in the churches, right? So what's changed in the last few decades is that we have new tools to make them in a very controlled way. We have new tools to look at them individually from a structural point of view and from property point of view.
Yeah, and we also understand why there are these different colors.
That's right. So, you know, for example, you mentioned gold colloidal particles. We studied those as well. You know, gold colloidal can look reddish, so does quantum dots. But why do they look reddish are different from a physical point of view. You know, the gold
yeah.
particles scatter light.
Yeah.
That's why they look red. But the semiconductors, they're absorbing photons of a higher energy than they emit. So they're very different physical processes. As a result, you would control them to achieve different kind of property using a very different strategy. So before, it's more of centuries ago, it's more of trial and error. Look what we found. And now we can start to design materials. Like you can say, I want this. Now where do I go?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I always thought it was fascinating how they discovered these things. Because I remember reading also that the Romans and the Greeks going way back were using silver colloids to purify water. So these colloids are pretty ancient, but right. now we understand them a little bit better.
Right.
So you were talking about quantum dots. Mm-hmm. And I know that the quantum dots are making flexible solar cells that could be wrapped around
That's right.
Trees or whatever you have. Mm-hmm. Could you explain to some of our audience a little bit more what you mean by a quantum dot or what the material is that are typically quantum dots now?
Okay, so by quantum dot, I'm going to limit that name for semiconductors. So people are using what we call 2-6 or 3-5 material. They're just corresponding to different columns, the periodic table. And the ones we've studied, for example, are cadmium selenide.
Cadmium selenide.
That's right. And the cadmium selenide quantum dot, indium arsenide quantum dot.
Indium arsenide.
That's right. So, maybe I can go on to talk a little bit of why are we interested in them. You know, like you said, people are trying to make better solar cell with it. The reason for that, for example, is because by tuning the size, you can start tune where the quantum dot absorb and emit light. By tuning their absorption spectrum, you're taking advantage of a bigger part of the solar spectrum. You can absorb over a wider range. And of course, by tuning the emission wavelengths, you can design whatever, say, LEDs that you want light to come out of. You know, LED are the kind of light source.
Light-emitting diodes,
that
LED.
Light-emitting, that's right. They are the kind that will replace less energy-efficient light source.
I mean, it seems to me that we have them in certain places being installed right now.
They are, you know, certainly. And these things are made of semiconductors, you know. Whether we want to make them out of quantum dots, there are other considerations come into play, you know, how expensive it is to make them.
Why are light-emitting diodes more efficient than plugging your light into the wall?
Right. So the light bulb that we're using, I believe candlescent light bulb?
Incandescent.
Incandescent. Yes. That word is too long for me. Anyway, so the way that works is you're passing current through a thin wire, and the wire heats up to a very high temperature. Then they glow. And then with the LED, you're actually engineering where the electron energy levels are in solids. And that dictates the light emission process that just more efficient than heating something up and have it emit light.
So basically what you're doing with an incandescent bulb is wasting heat.
Absolutely. If you put your hands near the light bulb, you burn yourself.
But an LED is just cool.
That's right. So certainly in the summer in Texas, you don't want to be near a heated light bulb. You know, they're just turning into energy into the wrong place.
Okay, we're here listening to Xiaoqin Li, Elaine, and she's talking about colloids, and we'll be back in a minute.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Just about every important drug or therapy today is possible thanks to animal models such as lab mice.
But we're starting to see scientists favor an unexpected lab animal, the zebrafish. The small freshwater fish is native to India and makes a great model for studying aspects of human disease.
That's because its entire genome is already sequenced, its genes are easily manipulated, and its embryos are transparent and mature quickly. A couple recent studies show why they're important.
In one, scientists studied whether a human gene called SETDB1 spurs the growth of melanoma, a deadly skin cancer. To find out, scientists introduced a copy of the gene into zebrafish embryos, with the goal of having the genes become a part of the melanocytes, cells that pigment the skin.
Once that happened, the protein that the gene encodes began to change cell functions and prevented other genes from working properly. This accelerated the growth of melanoma, which scientists believe happens in humans. Future studies can target this gene.
Another study uses zebrafish to explore autism. Fish aren't autistic, but we do share genes involved in the disorder. The research focused on 24 genes missing or duplicated in people with autism.
One at a time, scientists deleted these genes in zebrafish embryos and watched for brain abnormalities such as changes in brain tissue and in the structure of axons, which transmit signals between brain cells.
Again, the results can help researchers focus on new treatments for autism. Who would have thought a tiny fish could be so helpful?
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
We're back, and we have Professor Xiaoqin Li, who we're going to call Elaine, from the Physics Department at the University of Texas at Austin, who's been talking about colloids and how they can make us more efficient in energy and light and so on. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about your specific research.
Mm-hmm. So I can go on for hours.
I mean, you
on
talked
this,
about cadmium selenide. Is that
right.
The main focus?
Not necessarily. One of our main focus is really control electron, individual electrons, control the process of they emitting light on the level of a single photon at a time. So we're really pushing the frontiers, you know, how you can control light-matter interaction in the ultimate quantum limit. You know, for example, people who are in quantum information are interested in making a light source that emit one photon at a time. Why would you want to do that? Right. Imagine you're trying to transfer emission. You're trying to cast a vote for the president. You want a bit of information being zero represent Obama. You want one being represent the other candidate. And you don't want anyone else to know about this information. What is the most secure way you can cast this information? Right. You cast it. You encode it on a single photon. So if anyone try to listen to you know, try to intercept your information, that photon will be forever lost, and you will know someone is trying to interfere with this process.
You don't think there's some secret physicist that would break that code?
Well, you know, this is a sort of a security guaranteed by, you know, fundamental basic physics principles. So, you know, send your information one photon at a time.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit for our audience and say we know that the sun has a certain spectrum of light,
you right.
know, yellow, red, and it has some infrared and it has some ultraviolet.
That's right.
So the idea is to adjust the materials so that all of that, those photons that are coming from the sun, if we can, mm-hmm. are converted into electricity.
That's right.
Can you do that with one material? Or do you have to have multiple materials? Or put it another way, supposing you had a variation of three different sizes of quantum dots.
Right. So, you know, you're hitting a great point. Right now, the solar cells are made of, you know, a single crystalline silicon, right? They do a very good job, and they're very economical.
So they're about 21% is the top. I don't know the efficiency is.
Somewhere there, maybe 13%. I didn't.
Somewhere around
you know,
there,
but
it's not
100% exactly,
or even 75%.
Far from that. Right.
Yeah.
So, and then, like you said, in order to harvest a broader range of a solar spectrum, we can think of maybe stacking a few materials together, right? But then you really have to think about how do I do this cheaply? That's the main challenge there.
So is it conceivable that, let's say, if we think of them as the colloids as spheres, you know, we have some that are 10, 40, 100 nanometers, and therefore there would be a material that would be specifically designed for a certain part of the solar spectrum?
Right. So each particular material would have some fundamental limit. You know, for example, with things we call band gap, meaning a range of energy that electron cannot occupy. That's why it's called a gap. Right. So it's very difficult to imagine a single material would harvest the entire solar spectrum. So the idea you propose using a few materials is an excellent one. You know, people have explored that. It, like I said, sometimes it's a matter of cost.
Yeah, so this idea of band gap, basically you have all the electrons, then you have some unoccupied levels above.
That's right.
And the photons from the sun kick them up.
Right.
Okay, into the unoccupied part. And then there's a process by which, as they relax, you get electrons.
That's right.
So this gap has to be tuned to each part of the spectrum.
That's right.
And so most of the light, like 40% of it or something like that is in the middle, yellow and around there. So the current materials are sort of tuned around the maximum photons. And what we're trying to do is to get the rest.
Yeah, in a way, that's true. You know, silicon, for example, its band gap, it's near 1,000 nanometers. So it is, to the lower energy side of the visible spectrum. But like you said, solar spectrum is very broad. And that doesn't do all it needs to do to harvest as much as we can.
You're working mostly with cadmium selenide or some other materials?
We're not entirely limited with cadmium selenide. It's just a convenient type of quantum dots. You can make them in your kitchen. You know, I don't recommend doing that. You do need some pressure gas. You know, heat them up for a few hundred degrees. It's just convenient. We can buy them.
Not making them yourself.
No, I wish I've learned my chemistry better. You know, don't fall asleep in your chemistry classes, which is, I did sometimes. And we buy them from a company, and that's why we use them. We do study other gold particles, and we also study some magnetic materials.
Well, gold is not a semiconductor. It's a metal.
Right, metal. So the way how metal come into play is very interesting. So there's this new field we call plasmonics. So it used the fact that, in metals, there are a lot of electrons that are running around. They're what we call free electrons. And when you have light incident on it, you actually can make this electron cloud sloshing back and forth. As a result, they interact with light very strongly. So you can think of it, a hybrid material has both metal and semiconductors. Metals are kind of the light concentrator, and the semiconductor is sort of an active element that emits light, for example.
Well, that's a new one on me. Let's go back to these electrons sloshing around in the metal, okay?
Right.
What do they do now if they're sloshing around?
So when they do that...
And what's making them slosh around? You're saying
the light, right? Light is really... there are two ways to think about light. They're both particle and wave, right? And now if you think about them in a wave picture, you really have this electrical field that's changing its direction and amplitude in time. They're sinusoidal function in a simple picture.
So light is interacting with this free electrons.
That's right.
Because of its... wave-like character.
Right, because it's an electrical field that's changing as a function of time. So it's moving the electrons back and forth inside a nanoparticle. As a result, it's a great way to shape light on a nanometer scale, which is awfully difficult to do if you're just using conventional optics like a lens. You probably all had a magnifying lens or you have those prescription lens. You cannot focus light to a very tiny spot with those optics because there's such a thing called diffraction limit. You cannot focus light better than than its wavelength approximately, which is 500 nanometer. But a lot of the nanomaterial we're dealing with are just a few nanometer. So how do you further concentrate light to a scale?
So let me say, with a lens, you can concentrate light to something like a tenth of a micron or something.
That's right. You know, half of the wavelength.
Yeah. Okay. So then you want to concentrate it even smaller.
Yes.
Why do you want to concentrate it? To focus it on the semiconductor?
Right, so that brings an interesting question. You know, a lot of the information processing are done in semiconductors, and a lot of the information transfer are done through photons, right? The signal run through the optical fibers are carried by photons. And there's a big problem that is the length scale mismatch. Electronics are already down to a 10 nanometer length scale. But photon using traditional optics cannot be controlled beyond 200 nanometers. So there's a big length mismatch. So people are very interested in controlling light on even smaller length scale. So these some design Mantella structure may help you to do that, except for they have its own challenge at the moment. It has a lot of loss. I hope answer your question.
So this sort of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the colors of the colloids.
Yeah.
Because the light interacts with these particles, metal, gold particles.
That's right.
And so that would be, I could see that be focusing. If you had the right ones, you could maybe bring the red over to the yellow or something like that.
Right. On a very small land scale, that's the key. These colloidal metal particles can be few nanometer. And then you already have a new tool to concentrate light and shape it on that small lens scale, which you cannot do with traditional optics like a lens.
Okay, so let me get you back to the chemistry then, your favorite subject. I mean, you can buy a gold colloid, I suppose.
That's right.
You're buying it different wavelengths or different sizes.
That's right.
In a bottle suspended in water?
Water.
So then how do you combine that with the quantum dots? I mean, can you describe maybe in the future a device?
Like I said, I wish I'm more of a chemist. But right now, I do kind of in a lame way that physicists know how to do. We just spin cast them onto a substrate. And we spin cast both of them, put them on a glass substrate. So they're both coexist. They're both existing.
So you put the gold colloid particles on the glass with the quantum dots, cadmium telluride, or selenide.
Yeah, I just spread them on this glass. Yeah. So I spread the gold particle first,
like with
and then
a paintbrush.
Yeah, exactly. And then I spread the semiconductors, and I study them that way. And what's interesting is their interaction is so sensitive. Sometimes I need to control exactly how they're positioned. So I use a very sophisticated, not me, actually my student, use a very sophisticated tool that we call atomic force microscope.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That in principle has the capability of seeing a single atom.
Yeah.
But we're not using it at that limit. Nevertheless, we use them to push around a few nanometer particles.
So you can have a gold tip on the AFM and put the gold here and put the gold there.
That's right. That's right.
Normally, maybe we're not supposed to invent on Science Studio, but could you imagine a solar cell that was completely liquid colloids?
liquid cell depends on how you, so first of all, energy storage, there are such a thing called fuel cells, right? And the medias are liquid. If you are looking for something that you can paint on the top of your roof, you want them to be probably carried in a different matrix. And so you can, just spread paint them and not worry about they get rinsed away,
Yeah, well, I know a lot of times we talk about the dream of having a solar paint.
Yeah.
But it's a little more complicated because it means you would have to paint your house first with aluminum or maybe platinum as a conductor.
No, you never want to do a platinum. It's not exactly my field, so I cannot speak with a great deal of knowledge, but I think the idea there is you don't necessarily want to harvest the electrons from the whole rooftop. You can use them locally to do something useful, like absorbing heat and do some cooling.
This is extremely fascinating, and I know that really a solar cell would be a conductor and then some material, semiconductors, colloids, and then a plate that lets the light through or glass or some coating like that. Mm-hmm. So that I think solar paint is a little bit out there far, but maybe you'll be able to go to Home Depot and just get big things to put on your house.
I think that's certainly not far stretched, and I think that could happen. I can't predict one. And I think it works in principle. A lot of scientists have shown that in their laboratory. It's a matter of efficiency and also a matter of durability. You may not want to paint your house, every week, right? So maybe once a year is durable.
In the last minutes that we have here, why don't you look out into the future? What would you see if you were working 10 years from now?
It's hard to predict things in 10 years, but I'm just always fascinated by light-matter interactions on the smallest scale, on the ultimate level that we can control that process, right? So I imagine this continue to be a main part of my research. But these days, science are very collaborative. Oftentimes, I have a colleague walking to my door and say, let's do this together. So I'm always keeping that possibility open. It's a great joy to work with people with different expertise.
We're very happy to have Professor Xiaoqin Li, Elaine, from the Physics Department at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks for being on Science Studio.
You're welcome.
Come back.
It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer. Tune in next week for another Science Studio. Mm-hmm.